Good morning and welcome to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for our show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Henry Frayne is at the controls this morning. Coal is an abundant and affordable source of energy. It also happens to be the world's leading source of carbon dioxide emissions. This morning, in this part of Focus, we'll try to talk about a technology that may make it possible to continue to burn coal to produce electricity, while at the same time capturing and storing the carbon dioxide that is produced. Our guest for the program is Rob Finley. He is director of the Energy and Earth Resources Center at the Illinois State Geological Survey, which is based here at the University of Illinois. And I'm sure that as we talk generally about this kind of technique, carbon capture and sequestration, we will also talk about what has been proposed here in the state of Illinois. As I'm sure people know, there was a proposal to construct a plant that would demonstrate how this could work in Mattoon. Now that seems to be up in the air. The question of its future funding is up in the air. We really don't know what's going to happen. The people there would hope that it would, in fact, go ahead. We just don't know. We can talk a little bit about what where things stand now, what we know about it, and certainly how that would work. And people who are listening, you're certainly welcome to call in with your questions, and I know that our guest would do his best to give you an answer. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us. So if it would be a long-distance call, use that number. That's 800-222-9455. So again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, thank you very much for being here.
Well, thank you for having me.
I appreciate it. Right now, how much of the electricity that we generate here in the United States is the result of burning coal?
Well, right now, about 50-52% of the total electricity generated in the U.S. is coal-fired. So coal is responsible for a very important part of our available electricity in this country.
Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that there are a lot of people, or I think a lot of people who would argue that because we certainly have significant need for energy, we have significant coal resources, that it is likely that we're going to continue to use that as a way of generating electricity.
Well, it is a domestic resource, and that's very important. We do have it in considerable abundance. We are improving the technology all the time to be able to use coal in cleaner and cleaner ways. And there's actually some potential to use coal to augment the supplies of liquid fuels. It's very important when you talk about energy to separate electricity and liquid fuels. Mm-hmm. And given that, of course, with a price spike last summer of oil at $140+ a barrel, it's really important to keep liquid fuels and electricity in perspective as two different types of available energy.
Mm. Well, and you talked about the fact that just slightly over half of the electricity is in the United States is generated burning coal. In what way does coal burning contribute to the problem of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and then thus to climate change issues?
Well, anytime you burn a fossil fuel, that is a fuel that is derived from ancient organic material, and that includes oil, natural gas, and coal, that fuel contains carbon. When you oxidize the carbon, you produce carbon dioxide. When you use a fuel like natural gas, which is predominantly methane, methane is CH4, so you have a lot of hydrogen there, and you result in a lot of water vapor when you oxidize that hydrogen. Coal, however, is the most carbon-rich fuel, so that when you burn coal, you get a greater proportion of carbon dioxide than you do, for example, when you use natural gas. So right now, the U.S. Produces about 7.2 billion metric tons of carbon dioxide emissions per year, and just under 2 billion of that 7 billion actually come from electric generation from fossil fuel coal-fired power plants.
Mm-hmm. Well, just let's set aside the issue of capture and sequestration for a moment. If you look at the kind of technologies that now have been applied to reduce emissions from burning coal, what are we doing there, and is that something that you think has that technology been taken to the point where we can't take it anymore, or is there still some possibilities? And here, I guess, as a layperson, I'm just thinking about the fact that you burn the coal, you got a smokestack, the emissions come out. So you do something to remove offensive matter from that before it gets out into the atmosphere. Have we done as much with scrubbing in the way that we have done it in the past, or is there greater possibility there?
Well, there certainly is greater possibility there, and however, the Clean Air Interstate Rule would require even less of certain criteria pollutants like sulfur dioxide, nitrogen oxides. We have certainly for decades taken fly ash out of power plant emissions. So, and now we're of course concerned about mercury as well. If we go to a greater percentage of scrubbing with so-called flue gas desulfurization aimed at taking out the sulfur dioxide, you also remove a certain fraction, more than half, of the mercury, depending on the chemistry of the mercury itself. So over the last, say, two decades, certainly the technology has improved to deal with sulfur dioxide, nitrogen oxide. It's improving now with the ability to deal with mercury using carbon sorbents. The big area that really hasn't been addressed is the carbon dioxide removal, and that's now just beginning to be looked at with the understanding that we've gained on the implications of carbon dioxide for global climate change, particularly the results of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change out of the UN. The results that have been gained in the last 5 to 10 years, I think, have really been significant in terms of increasing the emphasis on CO2 removal.
Just real quick, let me again, for anybody who's tuned in, reintroduce our guest, Robert Finley. He's director of the Energy and Earth Resources Center at the Illinois State Geological Survey. It's based here at the University of Illinois, here in Urbana-Champaign. His particular area of interest is fossil energy resources and carbon sequestration. And if you have questions, you can call us, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. The technique or the process that would be employed at, for example, the place like Futuregen, we're talking about building in Mattoon. How is that different from what you were just essentially just talking about?
Well, you have, when you think about coal-fired electric generation, the current fleet of plants are dominated by what we call pulverized coal plants. So it's basically the coal is, as the name implies, pulverized, fed into a boiler. The boiler is used to heat steam, and the steam drives the electric generation turbine. And then all of the emissions from the boiler, which is typically air-fired, have to be dealt with. When you fire a boiler with air, of course, air is about 80% nitrogen, you wind up with a lot of flue gas that you have to treat because the carbon dioxide and the other emissions are diluted within the within this large volume of nitrogen that comes off the boiler. And in fact, the stack emissions, the carbon dioxide in the stack emissions of a typical pulverized coal plant is only about 12 to 14% CO2. Now, when we're talking about the project in Mattoon, the Futuregen project, it's really a different process. It's called Integrated Gasification Combined Cycle, or IGCC, obviously, for short. And really what you're doing here is you're converting the coal in a limited oxidation process to a gas, and the gas consists of carbon monoxide and hydrogen. Then you can take that gas and you can react it with steam so that the carbon monoxide is converted to carbon dioxide and you get additional hydrogen out of this process. The hydrogen then becomes the fuel that you essentially burn in the turbines to generate the electricity. So because this process does not use air to supply the oxygen, it's typically supplied in high-quality form from a cryogenic air separation unit, or basically the oxygen's extracted from the air as a separate process and fed into the gasifier. And also because you don't have that large volume of nitrogen going through this entire process, it's much easier to clean up the emissions. You can actually get marketable sulfur, for example. You can use carbon sorbents a lot more easily to take care of the mercury. And this so-called synthetic gas, this carbon monoxide and hydrogen gas, is something that can be burned much more cleanly. In fact, you really only, in the case of Futuregen, it would be the hydrogen that actually drives the turbines. And what you can – now going back to the carbon dioxide for a moment, what's really important there is you can elevate the percentage of carbon dioxide in the gas stream to something in the order of 90 to 95%. So you have a relatively pure carbon dioxide stream, which is something that you can then sequester, the word meaning isolate or keep away from the atmosphere. And what we have been doing since 2003 at the Geological Survey is basically studying the geology of Illinois and nearby parts of southwestern Indiana and western Kentucky. And the subsurface geology is really quite amenable in this basin to putting the compressing the carbon dioxide. It's compressed to a dense phase, liquid-like material, and basically putting it into the subsurface. And so Futuregen would be basically first of a kind with regard to being a fully integrated gasification plant for use of coal and taking care of the carbon dioxide. So it's sort of earned the name near zero emissions because all of the so-called criteria pollutants will be taken care of, plus will be taking care of the carbon dioxide.
I have a caller here I want to get to, but real quick, let me just go back one step because I think probably when people hear this referred to in sort of general and lay terms, then they have this idea, well, okay, you're going to burn the coal and that you're going to get the carbon dioxide that you don't want to go into the atmosphere. You're going to grab the carbon dioxide and you're going to stuff it somewhere. And I imagine people are thinking, well, the carbon dioxide, it's a gas, right? So you're going to take that gas and you're going to inject it somehow underground. Well, that's not completely true. What you're doing is you're changing the form by what you're doing to it so that it's not gaseous carbon dioxide.
Right,
it's like it's like liquid?
Yeah, carbon dioxide is a gas. I mean, maybe some people are certainly familiar with it as dry ice. I mean, dry ice is solid carbon dioxide. A carbon dioxide fire extinguisher, they exist in many restaurants, carbon dioxide fire extinguishing systems. The source for that is liquid carbon dioxide. So carbon dioxide is a gas in everyday terms at room temperature and pressure, but it can be fairly readily converted to either a liquid or a solid. And in this case, we would use what's called a dense phase liquid. So if you think of it like let's create a unit of carbon dioxide, say, the size of a basketball. So you've got a basketball filled with carbon dioxide at room temperature and pressure. You could compress the volume of 1,000 basketballs down to the volume of less than 3 basketballs when you inject it into the subsurface through this compression process.
And though, I guess then immediately my question would be, well, what is it that you have to do to it to get it to stay that way? I would assume that it would much rather be in its free form gaseous state than be compressed into a form like that.
Right. Well, you have a compression facility that consists of a compression equipment, then you have a pipeline that will deliver it to a well. And basically, it's the reverse of the process, say, that you would use for producing oil or natural gas. Instead of producing hydrocarbons up through a wellbore, you're actually delivering the CO2 down through the wellbore. And in the case of Mattoon, we're talking about depths in the vicinity of 6,000 feet. And at that depth, the pre-existing pressure and temperatures are such that once you put the CO2 down there in this dense phase state, it stays there because just the normal pressure of the earth, of the overburden of the earth, is sufficient to keep it compressed.
And there would be no natural tendency of it to want to regasify and to seep out if it's there and the pressure and the temperature are right, then it will just sit there?
If the pressure and temperature are right, there are really two things you need. One, you need a reservoir to put it into, which is the tiny pore spaces in the sandstone into which we would inject the CO2. And then you need what we call a caprock. So the caprock is made out of shale, which is a low porosity, low permeability caprock. So at Mattoon, we have more than 1,000 feet of reservoir rock. We also have at least 300 feet of impermeable shale. So basically, it's kind of like putting it in a soda bottle, if you will. You've got to have a good cap to keep it in there. In this case, the geology of this part of Illinois is so favorable for this process, just in part because we have a good shale cap that is going to keep the CO2 in place.
We have a caller here, someone in Belgium over next door, almost next door by Danville. We'll talk with them here on our line number four, toll-free line. Hello.
Hello, and good morning to you all. Germany and South Africa both used huge coal resources to produce liquid fuels during their times of troubles, the Second World War and during apartheid for South Africa. So the technology is there to already liquefy coal residues. We also used a lot of it to produce coke. Now, probably you could find some way to put the carbon back in the ground and keep the stuff that comes off the coke for organics that you might want to use for fuel. But even given all those things that we might be able to do with it, there's just one problem you can't get over with coal, and that's the destructive aspect of mining it in West Virginia and Western Maryland, Pennsylvania, Eastern Kentucky. They strip off the tops of mountains to get it. Here, we strip off valuable soil to get at it. And you go to the Western United States, they create huge piles of offal from mining it. There's sure a problem with getting to it that has to be solved, too.
Well, absolutely, yeah. The mountaintop removal mining is absolutely unpretty, and if I had my vote, I would see that if we in some way we could avoid doing that, certainly. There are places in both the U.S. and the world where it is certainly mined underground. It can be safely and effectively mined underground. I think we have to keep in mind that when we're talking about certainly the atmospheric global warming situation, we got to look at this on a worldwide basis. It's not only what we do in the U.S., but it's looking at developing countries around the world that have these huge coal resources within their boundaries. And so we're not only, when we look at, for example, future gen and gasification and carbon sequestration technology, we're not only looking at it for the potential to use in the U.S., but I personally feel that if we do not become the leaders in developing some of this technology, that it's less likely, certain or even unlikely, to be done in other places in the world. So it's very important for us to keep a global perspective on this as well as a domestic perspective.
Well, what I was getting at, sir, is it seems to me that there has to be a logic to recover this resource without taking it out of the ground. In other words, mine it and process it, or however you might want to say it. You have to do it underground and leave it pretty much where it's at, but take out what we want. Take out the hydrogen, really, is probably what I get at. I'd really rather see us use the hydrogen and leave everything else behind.
Yeah, there were some experiments 20 to 30 years ago with underground coal gasification. They were not very successful in some regards because they were not handled very well, and they created some nasty materials that basically were left behind with the potential to get into groundwater and contaminate groundwater. But I think those technologies are being looked at again to see whether or not we can do, as you say, extract the hydrogen or the more hydrogen-rich components of coal without actually physically extracting all of the coal itself. But I think the verdict is out as to whether or not those technologies will be successful.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. On to another caller here. This is someone in Champaign in line one. Hello.
Yes, I had a question about the efficiency. Seems like there's a lot of processing that goes on to extract the hydrogen, and then so can you give us an idea of how much less efficient it would be to burn and sequester the coal than it would be than just to burn it?
Yeah, in the conventional pulverized coal plants, what's called the energy penalty, that is because where the flue gas is so dilute, you may actually wind up needing 20 to 25% of the power output of a given plant just to carry forward with the sequestration process, because you need process heat to regenerate the solvent that you use to extract the CO2. That is a huge area of research right now to try and to develop either more efficient solvents to avoid the so-called energy penalty for carrying out carbon sequestration, and to improve both the temperature and pressure at which these pulverized coal plants operate, or to move entirely to the gasification technology, which overall is much more energy efficient. So if we can move from, say, 30 to 33% energy efficiency to up into the 40s, mid-40s, or perhaps even higher with a gasifier, we're doing ourselves a favor because we're getting more electricity generated for using the same amount of fossil fuel.
Great. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Here, I want to ask a question. I'm not quite sure how to formulate it, but I guess it gets at the same kind of question that the caller was asking, specifically to the kind of technique that would be, if they were going to do it at the Mattoon plant, that they would do it. And that has to do with the fact that it takes some energy to generate the energy. And how much how much energy the whole process uses, because you've got to break down the coal so you can get your hydrogen to burn to make your electricity, and then you have other stuff that you perhaps have to deal with, and then there's the energy that's required then to take the carbon dioxide that you've captured and do what you need to do with it to get into storage in the form where it will stay. Now, you said that this is maybe more energy efficient than the more conventional kind of plant that we've talked about, where you basically just pulverize the coal and you burn it.
Right.
But what can you say about how much energy it actually takes to make this process go?
Well, I probably couldn't give you specific numbers or tonnages, but certainly every time you generate, for example, I mean, electricity is when you talk about the fossil fuels, you're talking about primary fuels. When you're talking about electricity, you're something that is generated through a conversion process. So every time you go through this conversion process, you lose some basic number of BTUs that were essentially available in your fuel. It's waste heat. It's activities that you have to carry out, such as pulverizing the coal, using blowers, providing cooling water pumps, and so forth. So this gets into the whole range, I think, of energy efficiency and conservation that we also need to be practicing. So as the world demand for electricity is growing, one not only needs to look at what kind of fuels you're using, but one also needs to look at what kind of energy efficiency can be achieved both on the downstream end by the user, for example, as well as by the electric generator themselves.
And this particular technique that we are talking about, has anyone anywhere in the world actually done it and demonstrated that, in fact, it can be done?
Well, that's a really good question, because, in fact, the two existing gasifiers that are actually operating in the U.S., one is located in Indiana, in that area, and one is located in Florida at Tampa Electric. However, those technologies are both were built in part with at least 50% DOE funding, as I recall, in the late 1990s. So you've got some certainly newer technologies, but Tampa Electric, the plant is relatively small, but it's actually the most efficient of that utility's electric generating facilities. So they've been running it. Once they got through some of the original problems, they've actually got that plant running, and they run it on a continuous basis. So there are a couple of gasifiers also operating in Europe, but again, they've been around for a while. So there's new technology, and by the way, neither of these plants, neither the Indiana or the Florida plant, capture their CO2. So that is a unique aspect that would be new for the FutureGen facility.
So part of it has been demonstrated, that they say, well, yeah, we can do the gasification part. We know how to do that. It's the part that still hasn't been demonstrated is the capture and sequestration
part.
Right,
and particularly it's the integration of the whole plant. It's the integration of the whole process from start to finish, because there are things you want to do with that syngas that comes off the gasifier. There are ways in which it's difficult to burn pure hydrogen in a turbine because it burns very hot. It also can create additional nitrogen oxide emissions, and those have to be addressed. So there's a lot of technology that has to be fully integrated. That's why it was such a shame, and everybody was so totally disappointed when the Energy Department canceled that plant. But I think there is reason for optimism now with the incoming administration to revive that plant. Mm.
And it's the case that what you're going to have to do if you're going to do this is you're going to have to build a new plant from the ground up you're going to have to identify the place where you think the geology is good so you can store the carbon dioxide, because it's essentially you can't ship it off to someplace else. The idea is that you have all this happening in an integrated process at one site, which means that if you're going to do this, you're going to have to build a new plant right from bare ground.
Well, that was one of the beauties of the two. You recall that in this process of finding a site for FutureGen, that the two sites in Illinois, the one at Mattoon and the one in Tuscola, were the two sites in competition with two final sites in Texas. Our sites, and particularly the Mattoon site, Mattoon was the only site where sequestration could take place actually immediately beneath the plant. For safety and environmental reasons, the Tuscola site needed an injection site that was about 10 miles away. That was a requirement that was put on the initial proposal process. In Texas, the CO2, as I recall, had to be transported at least 50 miles from both of their finalist sites. So, again, Mattoon was an excellent site because, again, the favorability, as you suggest, of the geology was a key criterion picking that site.
So now, as you said, people in Mattoon were extremely disappointed when initially they got the go-ahead, and then the administration said, well, we think this is really too expensive, and so they decided not to do it. The people there, I think, are hoping that it's possible that it would still go ahead. I know our representatives in Congress, Illinois senators and representatives in Congress, would like to see it go ahead. Do you have any sense of what the possibility is indeed that it would go ahead?
Well, I think the possibility is quite strong. Senator Durbin and Representative Johnson met with Energy Secretary Designate Chu Wednesday of last week in Washington. The press reports that came out of that were favorable in the sense of I think the Secretary Designate understands the importance of this project to the nation and to Illinois. The project, it was a travesty in my view that it was canceled. It really contributed to a loss of international leadership that I think we had been poised to carry forward here within the U.S. So I think this technology is not only important to us, it's important globally. And I think the incoming administration will look back at this and say, we should go forward with this because not only do we need that technology in the U.S., we need to be a global leader because there will be far more coal burned in developing countries in the coming decades, and the annual percentage increase in their use of coal is far greater, perhaps four times as much as ours.
We are a little bit past our midpoint. Our guest is Rob Finley. He's director of the Energy and Earth Resources Center at the Illinois State Geological Survey. It's based on the campus of the University of Illinois here in Urbana-Champaign. His area specialization is fossil energy resources and carbon sequestration, and he's currently leading a major project looking at geological carbon sequestration in the Illinois Basin, aimed at getting at concerns of global climate change. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And we do have some other folks standing by in Champaign. We'll go first to line number one. Hello.
Yes.
Yes.
I had a question about water, and something that I remember reading about FutureGen was the amount of water that would be required, and especially from the aquifer, and it seemed like a large amount, and I remember some people having concern about that, and I was wondering if the guest could comment on this.
Yes, there's really, as I recall the number, it was something on the order of 2 million gallons a day. But again, FutureGen the Mattoon site, I should say, was really quite unique in their approach to this, in that the proposal is to use virtually all of the treated wastewater, basically the treated sewage water from the city of Mattoon, and if necessary, to supplement that through a pipeline with the treated wastewater from the city of Charleston. So rather than withdraw virgin water, if you will, from the Mahomet Aquifer to support this plant, the treated wastewater from those two cities would provide the raw process water that the Mattoon site would utilize.
Sounds good. Thank you.
All right. Let's go to line two. This is also someone in Champaign. Hello.
Hello. I excuse the lack of chemistry, but is there any way that the carbon dioxide could be reutilized?
Well, the one thing about the bond between the carbon and the oxygen is it's a very strong bond. It's a bond that once it's formed, it's relatively difficult to break. People have talked about whether the CO2 in the future might be a source of carbon that could be used in fiber composites or fancy carbon and atom link type structures and so forth. If that technology improves such that we can break that carbon-oxygen bond in some efficient way and actually use the CO2, a fair portion of that CO2 that we put into the subsurface will be there for a long time, and it could potentially be produced and reused. So right now there doesn't seem to be much use for it, but if there were some technological progress... We know where it's at.
Uh-huh. Well, thank you.
All right, thank you. And to another caller. The next is in Indiana, Princeton, Indiana, on our toll-free line, line four. Hello.
Hi. I'm wanting to look at the larger picture here. Whenever you think about a hydrogen economy and you think about the coal that has to be mined and then gasified, and particularly if it's a merchant gasification facility, you gasify that and then you can't transport hydrogen, so you have to move it on a pipeline. And you look at that total of infrastructure that has to be developed, and then you compare that to nuclear, where the electrical distribution is probably 50% developed. And when you have nuclear, the waste that you have to store is minuscule by comparison of the amount of CO2 that you have to sequester. And I'm asking, what do you think about just looking at the two of them there and looking into the future? Doesn't the infrastructure that goes into hydrogen seem extremely large at this point to have to develop?
Yeah, I would certainly agree with you. If you're talking about ground-up first-user use of hydrogen, you're talking about building potentially a pipeline system. From my observations, I've seen that the hydrogen as a fuel or a hydrogen economy, so forth, it's gone from a lot of enthusiasm for that to perhaps a little less enthusiasm, perhaps in recognition of just the kinds of issues that you've mentioned. It's difficult to handle. It can leak out of a lot of conventional pipes and fittings because it's a very small molecule. So nuclear, I think really part of your question relates to the idea that there's got to be a portfolio approach going forward, and many, many people believe that nuclear indeed will have a role.
And I try to keep up on transportation energy use. And I understand that if you go with the electric route and you look at the grid for transportation and the battery storage energy issues are just so low by comparison to hydrogen, but yet the hydrogen seems to have such a long way to go in order to get into someplace where it makes practical sense that I'm like you. I just don't – it doesn't look very good to me. And, in fact – then I look at also the biofuel thing where the efficiencies are extremely low, even though the energy flux is there. But when you look at all these things put together, the transportation field doesn't have a lot to look forward to in terms of energy.
Well, I think one of the things that people are hopeful for in the transportation field is not only the hybrids that exist today, but actually the so-called plug-in electric hybrids that with advanced battery technology will allow people to plug their cars in at night. And I think I've heard capacity numbers like the first 40 miles or so could be totally electric, not just the combination of gasoline and electric that, for example, a Toyota Prius uses today, but actually full electric drive based on their battery capacity for what might be their daily commute usage. So, again, if those types of vehicles become predominant, You do two things. You reduce the use of liquid fuels, basically petroleum oil for gasoline, but at the same time, you're going to need the electricity as all these folks are charging up their cars overnight.
And do you see any answers for the commercial transportation market where you need an energy medium that has a higher specific energy storage ability?
Well, that's tough. I think most folks have said it's going to be really hard to to replace the energy density of jet fuel in an airplane, for example. It's just simply perhaps no alternatives there, and perhaps the same may apply to vehicles that might drive several hundred miles a day that are in commercial use that go beyond envisioned range of plug-in electric hybrids.
And then if you look at the total carbon footprint, can we meet the future demands for our reduction in carbon footprint if we don't get away from fossil fuel and commercial transportation?
I think that's where a lot of energy conservation and efficiency, we need more efficient vehicles. We need a whole portfolio approach. And I think time will tell. I probably wouldn't hazard a prediction, but many analysts who look at this suggest that we're going to need a combination of efficiency, renewables, alternative fuels like biofuels, plug-in electric hybrids, and nuclear to meet future demand.
You got a good, real good show here. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. I have some other callers here I want to get. I want to just ask a couple of basic questions here. Again, so people understand what we're talking about with the project that has been proposed, so for the FutureGen, and how that would work. As you have explained it, and as I understand it, and forgive me, I hope that I'm not oversimplifying, but essentially what you're doing is you're taking coal and you're going to take that apart. You'll take the hydrogen, and that is what you're going to burn to make the steam, to turn the turbines, to generate the electricity.
Right.
You're going to get some carbon dioxide, and that's what you're going to store. That's what you're going to sequester.
Correct.
Given how much space you've looked at the geology there in Mattoon, and you said that one of the good things about this place is that you can build the plant right on top of the place where you're going to store your carbon.
Right.
Given the amount of carbon dioxide that the plant will generate in normal operation, how much storage capacity is there? Or, you know, maybe one way to ask it would be, you know, how many years of operation could you get before you've stuffed as much carbon dioxide in this liquid form as you have described? So you've stuffed as much carbon dioxide in there as you can get.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's something we've actually got another project that is funded by the U.S. Department of Energy and by the with co-funding through the state of Illinois at Decatur, Illinois, where we're going to use CO2 from Archer Daniels Midland's ethanol production. And we hope to begin drilling that well in the next couple of months. And we'll get a lot more data about the geology of the sandstone, this Mount Simon sandstone that we're going to use. So that's part of an answer to your question, is to get more information. But the information that we have now in our proposal on the Mattoon site suggested that the first 5 to 6 years of operation, the radius of the volume of CO2 would be about 1/3 of a mile from the injection well, and that after 30 years of operation, the radius would only be on the order of 1.1 miles. So it is the storage capacity is perhaps up to 100 billion metric tons of CO2 in this unit within the Illinois Basin, and the CO2 generated during the life of the FutureGen project is on the order of 50 million tons. So it's a half of 1% of the capacity in the basin.
Right. And there will be other byproducts of this process. There are other things that you're going to end up with. You've got your hydrogen that you're going to burn. You've got your carbon dioxide that you're going to store. There are other things that you're going to end up with, some things for which there might be commercial demand you can actually sell. But
sure.
Then are there going to be other things that essentially are a hazardous waste product that you're then going to have to dispose of?
Well, the question is, for example, where does the mercury and the coal go? If we use a carbon sorbent bed that are used, then you wind up with activated carbon that has some of this mercury adsorbed on it. That basically has to be put in a lined landfill. But the volume of that is way small compared to some of the other constituents. It's pretty limited. So there's no free lunch when it comes to using any fuel of any sort. It's kind of interesting that somebody drew an analogy. If you were actually could see the carbon dioxide that came out of your tailpipe of the average car, it would be like dropping a charcoal briquette of the type you use in a backyard barbecue. You'd be dropping one of those out the window of your car about every half mile or so. So if you think about all the cars, and if you could see that carbon dioxide, you'd be awash in charcoal briquettes pretty quick.
And besides, one of the things you mentioned was that as a result of this process, you'd get some sulfur, which is something that actually would be a saleable, a marketable commodity. Are there a lot of other things like that, some kind of a chemical byproduct that there's a market for and one could actually think of as
sulfur is the main one I think of, although sulfur is a glut on the world market right now because we're extracting it from natural gas. We're taking it out of our diesel fuel to produce low sulfur diesel. Mm-hmm. There may also be some clinker or basically siliceous material, slag, if you will, that comes out of the bottom of the gasifier. That potentially could be used for road base, and there's been some work on that.
All right. Well, we have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Rob Finley is our guest. He's director of the Energy and Earth Resources Center at the Illinois State Geological Survey. It's based here at the U of I in Urbana-Champaign. His area of specialization is fossil energy resources and carbon sequestration, and that's what we're talking about here. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. The next up is in Champaign in line one. Hello.
Hi.
Mm-hmm.
It's a good program. I'm interested in Futurgen because I live over in the Mattoon area, and I was wondering what would be the danger of a long-term deposit of all that underneath the Earth's surface, and how it's going to affect the agriculture. Is there any danger in the agriculture that we have around in Illinois? What effect would that have? And also, there's a residue off of coal, isn't there? Like dust particles, like that comes off of coal when you burn it. What's going to happen to that?
Well, the dust particles that you refer to is so-called fly ash, and that's much more typical. I mean, that's a product of these pulverized coal plants, and they have to have various types of filtration and electrostatic precipitators to take care of that. The gasification process, as it would be carried out at Mattoon, is fundamentally different, so you don't produce that fly ash. So that's taken care of because it's a different process. As far as agriculture is concerned, your question is an excellent one and one that we dealt with over a period of a couple of years leading up to the selection of the Mattoon site. Bear in mind that the depth at which we would place this carbon dioxide is on the order of 6,000 to 6,500 feet. That's a long way from that upper 200 feet or so that is the soil profile and the glacial deposits that sit on the bedrock that support our soil profile and the very prolific agriculture that we have here in central Illinois. So we are very concerned about that, and one of the conclusions that we drew from several years of study of the Mattoon site was that it offers the maximum amount of safety for this process because, one, the reservoir is relatively large, and the reservoir is of a rock material that's dominantly silica. It's very stable. It's not a carbonate rock. And also because of the shale, the clay-rich shale that sits over the top of it. And when you talk about these cap rocks that I mentioned earlier, the Mattoon site not only has, and this applies also to our test site in Decatur and other areas of central Illinois, it not only has one of these cap rock seals, it also has two additional backup, a secondary and a tertiary seal. So the geology at Mattoon and in the central Illinois region is very favorable for the safe storage. And we will also devise a subsurface monitoring technique, so we will know not when if any leaks out, you know, when it gets to the groundwater. We will know immediately if it should leak in the subsurface before it ever gets past the secondary and tertiary seals. And that's one of the responsibilities that if the Mattoon project goes forward that our State Geologic Survey will undertake, and one that we're actually required by law to undertake, to make sure this monitoring is in place and make sure that the storage is safe and effective.
Well, thank you very much. That's really informative.
All right. Thank you. On to another caller here. This is someone in Bloomington, Indiana, on our line three. Hello.
Hi. I think it's really exciting that we're developing more efficient machines in response to global warming. Because as evidence accumulates that global warming is not happening, we can still use more efficient machines. But quefrostration of carbon dioxide reduces efficiency. You know, we have all this extra energy required. We have to isolate carbon dioxide, inject it deep underground. All this stuff will be a dead loss. Instead of increasing efficiency, it will substantially reduce efficiency. It'll have a big energy penalty.
That's absolutely correct.
Okay, correct me then.
Well, it's correct in the sense that you will be using energy to carry out this process. And while I'm not a climate expert such that I could comment on the validity of the climate models and so forth, I think when we started some of this work, say in 2003, there was a lot more skepticism about whether this was going to be worth doing. I think there is somewhat less skepticism now, but I think it's important to try and test this technology and understand whether it's safe and effective so it's available if we need it.
Okay. I think the evidence that global warming is not happening is increasing, not decreasing. However, the publicity, the politicization of science has increased. The evidence is simply going the other way, but it hasn't been publicized. However, nothing wrong with getting the techniques perfected so that you can use it if you need it.
Yeah, my view is that, you know, if the models and the data reach, say, 5-10 years now from now, reach a conclusion that this is beyond a shadow of a doubt, it would be really too late to start to perfect the technology at that point.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mark.
All right. And, again, just to make sure that people understand what we're talking about, because I'm sure that people are thinking about, you know, carbon dioxide, you're going to take carbon dioxide, which is a gas, and let's stick it in the ground. What you've explained is what you're doing here is that under the right temperature and pressure conditions, carbon dioxide essentially will become a liquid. And what you're going to do is then take that and put that into the ground at a level where the temperature and the pressure is such that it'll stay in that form. I may be sort of oversimplifying.
No, that's a good analogy. It does need to stay in that form.
Where it will stay in that form. Is the thinking then there are a lot of ifs here because nobody's ever done this. If you could demonstrate that, in fact, that would work, is the thinking that then your accumulated carbon dioxide in this form could just sit there and not cause any particular kind of problems, essentially could sit there forever or until the point where you decided that maybe you had some use for it and then that you'd pull it back out?
Well, there are actually several processes that occur. Once you put the carbon dioxide in the subsurface, it actually starts to dissolve in the salt water that's present in the rock unit now. So just in the same way you have carbon dioxide dissolved in a can of soda water, some of the carbon dioxide actually dissolves in the brine, so you actually reduce the volume of free CO2 by this dissolution process. Mm-hmm. The next thing that happens is you also get reactions with some of the minor minerals there. So eventually you actually tie up the carbon dioxide as carbonate rock over a period of time, by which I mean hundreds to thousands of years. It's a very slow process. So over a longer time frame, some of that carbon dioxide is no longer in the same form that you actually put it down there. It's actually tied up in the rock or in the brine that's down there. And as far as experience, there is a little bit of experience. There is one project in the North Sea where CO2 has been injected. 1 million tons a year have been injected since the late 1990s. There's a newer project in Algeria where BP, as British Petroleum, is injecting CO2. And just recently, within the last year or so, there's a small-scale test pilot project that has developed in the Otway Basin in Australia. Mm-hmm. So there is some global experience with this, and certainly we would bring the experience of those projects to bear on anything we do here in Illinois.
Now, and then before, you talked earlier about the fact that you were looking at a research project in association with ADM. To take some of the carbon dioxide that ends up being produced as part of their industrial processing and constructing one of these kinds of storage wells there. And essentially the idea here would be just to do a test, to do an experiment to see how it would work, what kind of problems would be associated with, and so forth. If would you then wait? Would you want to know the results of that before then you went ahead with something on a larger scale?
Well, the projects are really running concurrently, but as it stands now, bear in mind that we hope that FutureGen will be revitalized and refunded in sometime in 2009. We know the ADM project is going forward. We hope to begin drilling here perhaps within a month, 1 to 2 months. And the data will be perhaps emerging from the Decatur project a little bit before we would ever do anything at Mattoon. So we will gain that experience going forward
in a timely way. That's sort of what I was wondering was, yeah. You know, how long, if for your demonstration project, how long would it be before you would start getting useful data so you could start to say, well, we're actually learning something from this.
Yeah, we'll start to get useful data as soon as it'll take on the order of 2 months to drill the well. We'll get rock samples, core material. We'll get measurements from various tools that we can lower down that borehole. Those data will, if we say start drilling, say, in mid-February at Decatur, we will start having that data by mid-May. Mm-hmm. And my guess is it'll be certainly sometime this year, hopefully, before Congress actually moves forward with supplying the funding. So we'll be getting data in advance of even the funding actually going forward at Mattoon. Yeah.
And if indeed it does go forward at Mattoon, how long would it take to actually to construct this facility and have it start operating?
Well, as I recall, it would be about a 3-year construction timeline. There'll be about 600 construction jobs created, 100 to 150 permanent jobs. One thing that's really important to note is last December, a little more than a month ago, the corporate alliance, the FutureGen Alliance, the group of companies actually purchased the land, some 400 acres there at the Mattoon site. And the state of Illinois actually funded some geophysical testing that the ISGS, the State Geologic Survey, has been looking at the results of. And again, having the land purchased and having the geophysics completed that shows the site is as suitable as we thought it was several years ago, and even more so perhaps, I think are all favorable. So we're, this seems to now be tied into the concept of the economic stimulus package. This really is a so-called shovel-ready project to move forward. And we've completed the environmental impact statement. That over $1 million was spent completing the environmental impact assessment at Mattoon.
Mm-hmm. Well, there we'll have to leave it. I'm sure it's something we'll continue to talk about and follow. For the moment, we want to thank our guest, Bob Finley. Rob Finley. He's director of the Energy and Earth Resources Center at the Illinois State Geological Survey. It's based here on the campus of the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. Thanks very much for being here.
Thank you for having me.